Accession number 20375, Reel 1.
Bilby, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
Oxford in Middlesex.
Which year was this?
1931.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Uxbridge?
No, I was one of the 30 children that... Dad was a civil servant, and as a result we fluctuated between the East End of London and Middlesex. We moved, I suppose, in the 10 years between the 30s and 40s, 12, 14 times.
So do you have some particular area which you regard as your hometown?
Oh yes, I still think of Uxbridge as home. Even after 25 years army service, that's where we finally came back and settled.
Where did you have most of your schooling?
I suppose it would have been in and around Middlesex, because with the Blitz, we didn't get a lot of schooling. Not because the school's system wasn't working; it was that we didn't go to school. It was much more fun to play with in the bomb buildings rather than go to school. If you come out of the tower blocks, or they weren't then, they were tenements as they were called. If we came out of there and turned left and walked around the block, we used to be picked up by lorries because there were no buses and whatnot, but we were taken further down the road. The result was, it was, if you walked around the block, you missed the truck and therefore you didn't get to school. But at the age of 14, I joined the Royal Artillery Boys Battery, and I suppose that's when my formal education as such started.
What was your address during the Blitz?
Well, which one? We were bombed out, I think, 3 times. We lived in... We centred mainly in the East End, the Elephant Castle, Brixton, all around that area of the East End of London, the East India Dock Road and round that way. And we'd, as soon as we settled, we'd get blown and we move on to somewhere else, because back then there was so much rented accommodation that was available. You didn't worry too much about council housing or private housing or whatever. It was rented accommodation 99%, I suppose, back then in London. And as a child, I suppose, like most of the kids then, I run wild, basically. Dad was away. Dad was an ex-World War I, and he lost his arm at the Somme. And as a result, he spent most of his time either in the city as a Ministry of Health, or when they moved the civil servants out of London, they moved to Blackpool. We moved after a year, and we got a place up in a place called Buchanan Street. And the only bomb in the war that landed in Blackpool landed in our back garden. And mother being mother, trotted down to the local phone books and said, trying to ring the police or fire brigade or whoever, because somebody's gas oven had blown up. And this policeman came along and said, "Don't be a silly cow, that was a bomb, get home." So, again, being an East End mother, she turned round and said, right, you lot, pack. If we're going to get blown up, we're going to get blown up amongst our own kind. Because, again, we were south and we were now posted up north. And it was the north-south divide. I remember the school there, I had a very difficult time for the short time I was there, inasmuch as the accent was wrong, and we didn't seem to connect at all with the teachers. And I remember they had school inspectors back in them days, and he came in and asked various questions, and one of them was, can anyone spell the word people? And I think that was when I first learned, long before I joined the army, that you don't volunteer. Because I put my hand up and he said, stand up, which you did then, you know, you just stand, raised your finger. And he said, spell it. And I spelt it, and I spelt it right. And he said, I like this word because they always spell it wrong. And I knew in my heart that I was correct. But it felt as though I'd been put down and crushed. And I got home and I told Mum, and she said, well, don't worry. You know, that it was something he did probably in every class. But I never seemed to get on with it from then on. And I suppose what I'd be 12, 13 then. And the war was coming to the end. We came back home, and she said, I'd wanted to join the Navy. It had always been a thing that I wanted to go into the Navy. And for some reason, she got in her head that sailors didn't wear glasses. But we trotted off down to Acton, which was the nearest recruiting centre from Oxford. And like most recruiting centres, there was a recruiting sergeant as opposed to a recruiting naval officer. And he said, you know, oh, you do far better in the army, blah, blah, blah. And at 14, I enlisted, as I say, into the Boys' Battery Royal Artillery at the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich, which was, at one time, it was known as the College for Officers and Young Gentlemen. And some of the top brass in the 1800s had started their military careers there. And as I say, that's where I began to get educated. You started with the ACE3, which I suppose will be the basic education, English, maths, geography, history. And you did part of that in the mornings and part in the afternoon, with the rest of the morning and afternoon in military training, drill and whatever. And then I came out and went, that would be getting into the 48s. And I re-enlisted and went to Catterick as a trainee in the 8th Royal Tank Regiment. And I did my basic training as a radio operator and a gunner. And we then got the 8th Tanks finished their training stint and we moved down to Tidworth. As soon as we arrived, I met a sergeant major whose name escapes me now, but he and I didn't see eye to eye. And one day he called me into his office and he says, have you seen regimental orders? And I said, no. And he said, well, I suggest you go and read them. He said, because there's a bit on there that appears to have been written for you. And I went down and read it, and it said volunteers required for Far Elf. And I read it through, and they were looking basically for gunners, drivers, radio operators. And I don't think anybody in the world at that time knew where Korea was. But the basic bottom line said that we were given a 14 days embarkation leave, which seemed like a good idea at the time. So I trotted back to his office and duly said, yes, that sounds like me. And he said, fine, off you go, pack your kit and report to Bovington, which was the REC depot. And that was it. I went trotting down there, and there was a mass of just about every Armoured Corps regiment mixed up there, milling about, not quite sure what they were doing. In fact, none of us knew. One minute we were all kitted out because somebody had heard that Korea was Far East, therefore it had to be desert country. And we were kitted out in short shirts and Australian-style bush hats. And just as we got that all stowed away, somebody else came and said, oh no, they have quite cold winters apparently. And I said, are you sure? I don't think so. Because we're getting a little bit farther east than east. So we repacked and was kitted back to a normal British style of winter clothing. That is, two sets of long johns and a woolen pullover. And the next thing we knew, we were all trooping down to Southampton. And Her Majesty's ship, or steamship, Dunera, which was the biggest thing I'd ever seen, because the best solid boat I'd ever seen was on the Thames. And I'd never seen the sea. And we were all trooped up. And suddenly you go onto a troop ship back in them days, and you were packed in literally like sardines. I mean, it was three hammocks just slung one on top of the other, and you were crammed in there. There must have been 80 men on our mess deck, and that was a 6 week journey. And we used to troop, it was day in, day out. My first touch of seasickness was through the bay. We managed to be lucky to get a typhoon as we hit the Bay of Biscay, which made that boat do everything except float. And you come round the corner past Portugal and into the Med, and suddenly the weather changes, and everybody then grabs their blanket roll, and we slept on deck. And as long as you were up before the matlows were sponging down the deck, you were all right, because sailors don't care. And we went through, we stopped at Portside, and as I say, that's when you suddenly start to think the world is bigger than England. I mean, we've been taught that England was the centre of the universe. It was, back then, I mean, we were still an empire, basically. And we did our souvenir hunting and rooting around back on the boat. Then we went to Ceylon. Then we went to Japan. And with the army system of being able to divide people into groups, I don't know how they do it. And I mean, I ended up as a clerk, and I still don't know how we did it. But they seem to say, right, this lot goes to Japan, this lot stays on the boat and goes on to Korea. And I was one of the unlucky ones who went on to Korea. And that's when we get to the other side, disembark, and we then discovered that our tanks were still covered in grease. The barrels were solid, and we were supposed to be going to war. And we got the tanks on, tank transporters on flats on the railway.
Where was this?
This was in Pusan. And we were lucky in as much as all of the, we were reinforcements, because the 8th Hussars were already there. They'd been there, I suppose, 5 months before us. And they'd been tangled with the North Koreans in a battle called Cooper Force. And as we arrived, and we found that, as I say, we were all young, 18, 19, 20-year-olds, who had no idea what the world was about. But amongst us was a lot of ex-Desert Rat veterans from the 8th Army, who had been recalled back to the colours, and they had served with the 8th Hussars in the desert. And it was the sergeants and senior corporals that held the youngsters together, because, I mean, my sergeant was a chap called Bob Goodyear, who, when we arrived, we were divided up into, again, A squadron, B squadron, C squadron. Stay in them groups, because that's where you're going to join when you get back to the regiment.
Which one did you go into?
B squadron. And Bob Goodyear. And as luck would have it, I became his radio operator loader. And we got out there to on the Han River, which was Korea then. We were the 29 Brigade, but we were part of the American Army, inasmuch as the central core of Korean troops were the Americans. Being fair, we slang them off, but they'd taken all of the slack. They'd had a rough time, they really had. And we divided up into troops and whatnot, only to discover that the young officer that was in charge of B squadron had been killed 2 days previously. And Bob Goodyear took virtually, well, he took over the running of one troop B squadron. There was no troop officer.
Were you in one troop?
Yeah. I became his. There was, Bob was the tank commander. I was the radio operator. Taffy Evans was the gunner. And an Aubrey. I can't remember his surname. It's strange. Was the driver. That was the crew. Of. That became. And we moved from the Han, we moved forward to, I think it was 199. We trundled along. It was not tank country. No way was that. But we had the most advanced tank in the world at the time, and that was a Centurion. And as a result, we could take a tank where tanks wouldn't go. Was the basic tent. You could say the Shermans and whatnot of the Americans would look at a hill and go round it. We could take a look at a hill and say, right, well, we can get up there even if it's in reverse. And inevitably, we used to end up taking positions on the brows of hills that wasn't tank, as I say, wasn't tank country. Because once you got up there, you then either had to drop down below the brow of the hill on the wrong side, i.e. your side, rather than facing the enemy, which meant that you had to run up, fire your gun, and then run back again before they could take a shot at you. In fact, the worst time of the whole time I was there was when we were on Baldy, and we'd been sitting there for about 4 hours, I suppose. And that was the first time I actually saw a Chinaman. And they were down in the valley and on the other side. And there was hundreds of them, and I mean hundreds. And we'd run the tank forward. And all of a sudden, the most deafening bang and a skid, and it felt as though the end of the world had come. And apparently a rocket had hit the underside of the tank and run the full length of the underside of the tank. I mean, shot in a million. He'd never have done it if he'd have tried. It was a fluke shot.
A rocket.
We run the tank back. And because we were what they call closed down, that's every hatch and porthole was closed, and we're sitting in there. And I sat literally on a heap, a little warm heap. And for 2 days we were sat in that position of run forward, run back, run, because we couldn't get out of the. And when we did get out, and we looked at it, there was a gouge in the armour right the way the full length. But when you think that we were sitting on something like 100 shells of HE and AP shells, and even then, when you look back, you don't realise that that sort of thing can kill you. And you believe that you are invincible. At that age, you are not going to get. Everybody else might get killed, but you as an individual, it can't happen. It won't happen. When we were doing a run up country, moving from one position to another, one of the few occasions where we did a long forward march, and we turned this corner and the Northumberland Fusiliers had been our forward troops, and we brought the tank round the corner and there was this ambulance and bodies, and I think that's the first time that I saw an actual casualty and dead bodies, and the sounds and screams and smoke, and this kid holding his guts, and a medic sort of looking at him and saying, well, there's not a lot I can do with him. And we stopped and said, do you want to run out? And they said, no, you're in the way, get out of it. So we sort of pulled round them and went on. And we pulled up into our night position. And that was the first time we suddenly realised that we were in for a fight. Because the next evening, that was when the Gloucesters copped it, the Northumberland Fusiliers copped it, and we pulled my squadron, my tank, pulled the Northumberland Fusiliers out the next morning. and we heard that the Gloucesters had been hammered very, very badly that day, that night. They lost a lot of men. And again, I sat there that night and I tuned in the B set, which was the secondary set, and I could hear everything that was going on, but it was pitch dark, and I remember saying to Bob, can't we do something? Because you could hear these kids screaming, you could hear them shouting, you could hear the guns. I don't know if anybody's ever told you this, but whenever the Chinese put in an attack, they used to sound these tinny, screeching bugles. And that was the sign that they were going to come at you. And that seemed to go on for hours and hours and hours. In truth, it was probably four, because they preferred to fight in the dark. They would come at you in the dark. And that was the worst day of the whole time I was there, because there I was with possibly, as I say, the greatest tank in the world, the biggest armour, mobile armour, and I couldn't do a damn thing. I just had to sit and wait. And as I say, I had a man who had seen war in all its shapes and forms, and he didn't bat an eyelid. He probably felt as bad as I did, but he wasn't going to let me and the other two sitting in that tank. If he'd gone, we'd have probably all gone. And he just turned around and said, hold it down, we'll do what we've got to do at first light. We've got a job to do after this is all over.
Was this a sergeant?
The sergeant. A man and a half. And sure enough, the next morning, as soon as at first light, we got the word, move up. And to move up merely meant a matter of about 100 feet. And I mean feet, not yards, 100 feet. Just to bring the tank up above the crest of, so that you could then see what you were aiming at. And we laid down, I've got a photograph here.
Show me the letter, not now.
Yeah, we fired, I think my tank alone on that particular stint fired 140 rounds, more rounds than any other tank in the whole of the Korean War in any one particular battle. And that's when the Norfolks come streaming back through us.
The Norfolk?
The Norfolk Regiment.
Or the Northumberland?
Northumberland Fusiliers. And I remember it to this day. We were there, and we've now got the lid open, and we're sitting up, looking out, and we watch these kids coming back through, and we're passing them out a brew, because we could brew up on the tank. We had an auxiliary generator which used to brew water actually inside the tank. You didn't have to get out to make tea. And we were passing mess tins of tea and these kids carrying brain guns and whatnot. And one of them stops and says, can we have a look? So we sort of give him a leg up. And he peered over the edge of the turret and he looked down. Yeah, God, there's no way I could fight in one of them, he said. And I think it basically showed you the difference between an armoured corps man and an infantryman. There is no way I could have fought the war in a slit trench with just a machine gun between me and the enemy. Being surrounded by that armour, I felt completely safe. I don't think, even on the two occasions we were hit,